Communication, collaboration, coordination, and cash, right? We've all heard that, right? So today we have the four C's as well. A slightly different four C's. First we had the comic economist, who knew? A cartographer, a chlamydiast, and I'm not only the closer, but I'm going to talk about the criticality of maintaining a culture infrastructure within the health department. Thank you, Minneapolis. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about gonorrhea in New York City, what we know, what we don't know, what we're doing about it at the City Health Department, and why it matters. So for starters, what we know. In New York City, we get reporting from two sources. It's dual reporting. We get reports from providers. Those reports contain information on sex of sex partners, treatment given. We also have laboratory reporting, which since 2006 has been mandated to come to us electronically, and that's true throughout New York State, not just in New York City. In 2008, the city mandated antibiotic susceptibility test reporting from all of the labs that feed into our surveillance, from the labs that do culture that serve New York City residents. And we've implemented in the last year, we've implemented a surveillance software system that's going to enhance our ability to track site of infection, which is something that we really have not had a terrific handle on. So just to give you a sense of the scope of what we do, we got electronic reports from of about almost 30,000 laboratory reports that were received electronically last year. We received almost 3,500 provider reports. Of those reports, 75% of those came to us electronically, and the other 25% came on paper or fax or some other carrier pigeon. And then from that, we had 13,712 gonorrhea cases in 2011. We often talk about dual reporting, but just to make clear, only about 23% of our cases that are reported to us by the laboratory are also reported to us by the provider. So that has implications in the kinds of data that are available and the representativeness of the data that are available at any given time. You did see one of my predecessors in this session showed some of the national data on overall gonorrhea rates. And in 2011 or 2010, I think the national overall gonorrhea rate was about 100 cases per 100,000. Is that correct, gentlemen? And this is the same, some of the similar data is from New York City. Here you can see in red is our overall rate of gonorrhea. Yes, we've had the decline that Mark Stenger was talking about earlier, but we've also been seeing an increase in the last few years. And what's interesting about this increase is that I'm having a hard time with this mouse. I know that they wanted you to use the mouse, but I'm going to have to point a little bit, is that you see a splay. We have here the red representing overall, the blue line representing males, and the green line representing females. And what you can see is that there is a splay as of about 2004, and we see an increase in cases among males, which is not the national picture. And I think that Mark had referenced the fact that it might look different if you're from a large urban area, and this is one of the differences that we do see. To point out some important dates, though, in 2004, the STD clinics are served by the public health labs. We still maintain culturing infrastructure in addition to using NATS. And in 2004, our STD clinics were experiencing a prevalence of quinolone-resistant Neisseria gonorrhea, or GC, a QRNG prevalence exceeding 5%. In April of 2004, we issued a health alert to our providers with the news of what we were seeing in our clinics, and we urged all New York City providers treating gonorrhea to discontinue the use of fluoroquinolones altogether. Soon thereafter, actually, CDC put out an MMWR in which GISP, you know, based on similar findings of increases in QRNG, put out an put out an addendum to the MMWR treatment guidelines and recommended the discontinuation of fluoroquinolones only among MSM, which is a slight difference from what we had recommended. In September of 2006, the New York City Department of Health started from one of our 9 STD clinics was began submitting specimens to GISP, and we are one of the 28 sites that contribute monthly specimens to the gynecococcal isolate surveillance program in Atlanta. In April 2007, the MMWR did come out and discontinue the use of fluoroquinolones altogether. In January of 2008, in New York City, we made antibiotic susceptibility testing, if it is done at all, to be reported to the health department. And this was actually packaged within a larger mandate that covered other communicable diseases that also were interested in antibiotic susceptibility testing. So we were able to really synergize our interests there across our silos. And then in December of 2010, the new CDC treatment guidelines came out in which ceftriaxone 250 milligrams and azithromycin 1 gram were recommended as first-line routine treatment. So again, if we look at display, a line like this, given that there's so much screening that goes on in women, would suggest that men who have sex with men may have a very important role here in local gonorrhea transmission. If we look at male rates by age, so we're talking about person, I guess, within the age group that is most affected by gonorrhea among men is the green line, and that represents 20 to 24-year-olds. And you can see in 2011, our rate per 100,000 for men in that age group was almost 700 per 100,000. So a group clearly highly affected compared to the rest of the population, because the overall rates, as I mentioned, were, I think, about 150 per 100,000. And if we look further among men 20 to 24 years of age, and we look by race ethnicity, we do see that there is a huge disparity, and that black men between the ages of 20 and 24 are most recently experienced rates of about 1,100 per 100,000, give or take. And you can see that it really does exceed rates among Hispanic and white men of the same age group. If we look among women, the group that's most highly affected are the 15 to 19-year-olds, who most recently, according to our 2011 data, are experiencing case rates in the 900 per 100,000 area, I guess, for lack of a better word. And if we look at who, in terms of the person these young women are, you can see again that these are primarily black women young black women, 15 to 19 years of age, who are experiencing rates, again, close to 900 cases per 100,000, and that it's very striking when compared to Hispanic and white rates of among women in the same age group. Now let's talk a little bit about place. I'm going to digress a second and show you some data from the Community Health Survey that's done in New York City on an annual basis, asking about a range of behaviors, and this is looking at the data from the community health surveys that were done by the health department between 2005 and 2008. And what you see is New York City, and those black lines represent neighborhoods as defined by aggregates of zip codes. And you can see the prevalence of MSM that are reported in this representative survey of New Yorkers that's done on a yearly basis. And there is one neighborhood that really lights up. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with New York, this is, where's my mouse? Here's Manhattan, here's the Bronx, Queens, Brooklyn, and Staten Island. And this is the Chelsea neighborhood of Manhattan, where the prevalence of men who have sex with men is between 11 and 30%. If we look at male gonorrhea in general in New York City, there are three areas that light up. One is the Chelsea area. The other is the Harlems in Manhattan, as well as Central Brooklyn. And these are case rates in the 320 to 629 per 100,000. If we look among females, we see that The high rates include Central Brooklyn and the Harlems, and Chelsea has dropped out. So again, this idea that MSM somehow are important should be becoming a little bit more evident by some of the data that I'm showing you. This shows you, so as I said, all gonorrhea tests, positive gonorrhea tests are reportable to the health department. Over the years, more and more testing is done by nucleic acid amplification tests. And what you can see in this chart that shows you the percent of tests that are in culture, which are shown in red, and non-culture, which are shown in blue, you can see that the proportion of all positive tests that are reported to us are diminishingly of a culture nature. In 2011, we had almost 18,000 non-culture positive gonorrhea tests reported to us and 1,388 culture tests reported to us, culture results, positive culture results. And among those culture results, the public health laboratory happens to be a major contributor. About half of those come from the public health labs, but almost half of them come from elsewhere. And this shows you, what this shows you is of our 1,388 culture reports that we got, the percentage that come from each of the different sites, it's largely endocervical culture that's being reported as far as any plurality group, followed by 21% anal specimens, 18% urethral specimens, 19% oropharyngeal specimens. And there were some specimens where we didn't have a site, so they were not included on this slide. And to tell you a little bit about where the STD clinics are and the whole gamut of STD care that happens in New York City, for the most part, care happens outside the STD clinics. But gonorrhea is a bit unusual. In particular, if you look at, this is the male rate of gonorrhea in cases per 100,000. Here's the female case rate of gonorrhea in case rates per 100,000, and you had seen these on a couple of previous slides. These bars, however, show you what percentage of all cases reported come from the STD clinics. Among women, it's about 14% that are reported from the STD clinics, but among men, 31% of the gonorrhea cases are still being reported out of the STD clinics. For other diseases, it's far less than that. So what we do know is that New York City's gonorrhea rates do exceed the national rates. We know that our disparities, although the male-female difference is different in New York City than the national picture, we know that the racial ethnic disparities really mirror the national disparities and do really underscore that we have some conditions that have huge disparities. Men who have sex with men, however, is our population of greatest concern. It is a neighborhood that has very high rates of disease, high rates of MSM. We know historically in New York City, our data have shown us that we saw QRNG first emerge among MSM. And so we are really very concerned about this population. And we also know that cephalosporin azithromycin regimen is the last remaining truly first-line recommended regimen from CDC. So detecting MIC creep or loss of susceptibility in gonorrhea at this point does require having some sort of a culture capacity and to be monitoring that. So some of the gaps that exist nationally, as well as in New York City, of course, is that the epidemiology of extragenital infection, whether we're talking about gnats or culture, is really not well understood. And I guess Kyle Bernstein is the star of the day today, Mr. Gonorrhea, Dr. Gonorrhea, who's really brought that to the fore and to people's attention in different health departments across the country. There are also gaps in population-based culture and minimum inhibitory concentration information. Minimum inhibitory concentration, which I'll be referring to as MICs, that's the least amount of drug that you need to kill the bug, in this case the bug being gonorrhea, Neisseria gonorrhea. That the actual correlations between the cephalosporin MICs and the clinical response to treatment are really not well understood at this point. And that viable treatment alternatives to cephalosporin azithromycin regimens are really an important gap that we need to fill, and I think there's been a fair bit of discussion about that here at this meeting. So to tell you a little bit about what we're doing about things in New York City, well, we've certainly undertaken some control measures as far as addressing our increasing gonorrhea rates, and these have included some population-based activities. We do school-based screening in neighborhoods with high rates of gonorrhea and chlamydia. We do case follow-up at our Crown Heights STD clinic, which is in central Brooklyn, one of those hot spots that you saw for both men and women. Jail-based screening happens for gonorrhea among men under 35. And we're working hard to anticipate the emergence of cephalosporin-resistant, or CEPHRNG. I guess I learned at this conference it's MARNG. Multi-antibiotic-resistant NG. Nice to hear your gonorrhea. And I'm really going to focus on this resistance issue. We're really working on two different prongs. We are using laboratory-based activities as well as clinically-based activities. The first thing that we did was back in 2008, we mandated the reporting of all gonococcal antibiotic susceptibility tests to the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. We established breakpoints using the GISP alert values. We established breakpoints for cephalosporin MICs that really required further public health attention. We expanded the reference lab capacity at our public health laboratories. Again, they serve the STD clinics, and that happens to account for about half of the gonorrhea cultures that are being done right now in New York City, to make sure that the relevant cephalosporins were included. And we included Cefixime only as of 2011. And we did do an assessment of New York City laboratory capacity in terms of the assays that they do and their capacity around antibiotic susceptibility testing, which I'll tell you about in a minute. And we've been working to encourage labs to develop extragenital NAT testing capacity as well as whatever culture capacity they may have. So in terms of the clinical lab capacity survey that was done a few weeks ago, there were 25 labs in New York City, or serving New York City residents, that reported at least 4 positive GC culture results in 2011. Among those 25, there were 21 that performed cultures in-house. 11 of the 21 do antibiotic susceptibility testing in-house, and all 11 included cephalosporins, which is good news. 13 of 24 do GC NAT testing in-house, but none were also validated for extragenital NAT testing. Another thing that we did was we sent an alert to all laboratory directors in New York City or serving New York City residents. And in that alert, we reviewed the reporting mandates, the antibiotic panels that were needed for antibiotic susceptibility testing, and the breakpoints we were using. Forget that it says to trigger reporting, that's just an error, because they're supposed to report any AST test that is performed. However, we did stress the need to forward any isolates that cross the MIC thresholds to the public health labs for further evaluation, as well as to forward those specimens on to CDC for their gonorrhea library. And we continue to contribute GC isolates for the GISP program. And as important as the GISP program is, I believe it's been mentioned in other talks today already as well. GISP is a really important way to keep a finger on the national pulse of what's going on with antibiotic susceptibility. However, it is not a system that anybody should be relying upon for timely information to make recommendations around treatment or for working with the providers. It's a bit time lagged in that regard. Other things around enhanced lab surveillance, we maintain the use of culture at our 9 STD clinics. Culture is primarily used not just for GISP, which is one site of our 9 sites, but it is used to augment our NAT testing capacity to include oropharyngeal and rectal testing. We continue to participate in GISP, again, this one site, but What we do at that site, we've expanded to include cervical cultures as well, just so we can keep an eye out on what's going on among women. We continue to culture extragenital sites and now have added select urethral sites among MSM at one of our STD clinics, our Chelsea STD clinic, that neighborhood that lit up for MSM. And that's as part of the STD surveillance network, or the SUN. And we are in the process of trying to expand our surveillance to include a couple of sentinel providers that we would assist with culturing capacity within the city and having those cultures processed at the public health labs. As far as our clinical activities or clinically focused activities, we've established definitions of clinical treatment failure, and we are soon to be issuing guidance for looking for, reporting, and managing clinical treatment failures, as well as the management of GC infections with MICs that exceed the GISP thresholds. So far, these have been promulgated through the STD HIV Prevention Training Center, through Grand Rounds, and through the Health Alert, and soon through our Health Alert Network to primary care providers. Hopefully soon after we get home from this meeting, in fact. We are also working to identify possible treatment failures using our own surveillance data. So to share some of the data with you, and these were presented this morning by Dr. Julie Schillinger, these are the Neisseria gonorrhea isolates with AST results for ceftriaxone that were reported to the City Health Department in 2010 and 2011. And you could see that this is number of isolates along the y-axis, and these are different groupings of MICs along the x-axis. 2010 is represented in blue, 2011 is represented in green, and the GISP breakpoint is for ceftriaxone is zero, greater than or equal to 0.125 micrograms per mil. And we had 29 isolates that equaled or exceeded that breakpoint. These 29 cases were predominantly male cases. As I mentioned, we just added suffixime to what the public health labs do, and so we only have data for 1 year here. And we have had, again, it's the same axes as previously. You could see that none of the specimens have exceeded that breakpoint of 0.25 micrograms per mil or greater. So in terms of anticipating CEPHAR-GC in New York City, our activities have included enhanced active case follow-up of GC-MICs that exceed the cephalosporin breakpoints, and I've told you that about the 29 this morning. We also are doing active case follow-up on any GC treatment failures, although we are not aware of any to date. We are helping to verify and guide appropriate treatment, retreatment, and tests of cure for gonorrhea in the New York City provider community. We are interviewing cases that exceed those MIC or that hit those MIC breakpoints or go beyond them for risk factors, and we've begun already initiating partner services to retrieve partner isolates and to assure that partners get an appropriate workup and treatment when they've been exposed to a case. So why does it matter? Well, resistance in New York City is likely to happen early. It's true that resistance is usually first seen on the West Coasts, but it seems to then jump to the East Coast, and New York City, again, is one of the places that picked up on QRNG early compared to the rest of the country. We've implemented laws that make culture and AST data timely and immediately useful. And for those of you who are involved in programs, we have really been lucky in so far as we've been able to work with the Board of Health to change laws to really support the activities that we need to do. And I think we are unique in this AST reporting law. I'm not aware of anybody else that's doing that. We have an established culture infrastructure, and we are not ready to dismantle it at this point by any means. We also have a library of isolates that we're sharing with CDC as they arise. And we have enhanced our surveillance activities for the timely detection of MIC creep and treatment failures. New York City GC isolates with increased MICs are available for further study in the understanding of cephalosporin resistance. The New York City population-based isolates and data are available to help inform national GC treatment recommendations. And we've been working pretty closely with the GISC folks as we've been strategizing around each activity. And so I'm thanking them, shouting out to them right now. And research is really needed to enable the tracking of gonococcal antibiotic susceptibilities using NATS testing, because the fact that I'm here talking to you about cultures is like back to the future. And we need to be able to pick out what the susceptibilities are using NATS, because that's what most of the world is using. I'd like to thank my co-authors, Julie Schillinger, Preeti Patella, Kate Washburn, Ellen Klingler, and Kimberly Johnson. And thanks. I'm happy to take out on any questions that you have.
Hi, Sue. That was great. Thanks. I had one question about your pie chart of, I think it was from your...
The cultures.
What were the 18% others? A lot of eyes?
We get eyes.
Lots of eyes. Okay.
Eyes, joint fluids, you know.
Okay. Thanks.
Anything else? I'll find this by the time the last question shows up.
Hi, Susan Phillip from San Francisco. That was really interesting. So does your public health lab, was I hearing you correctly, that you're not, they're not validated for extragenital NATS currently?
They are not validated for gonococcal NAT. They are validated for anorectal GC NAT. I mean CT NAT.
Okay.
And I believe have just gotten the validation for rectal GC NAT.
So it wasn't a philosophical objection. It was just a technical.
Yeah. You know, in New York State, there is a regulatory body that supersedes CLIA, actually, and makes CLEP, right. And so they had to do the validation for CLEP, and there was a lot of back and forth about getting that validation approved. Mm. When commercial labs have approached us about validating for extragenital NATS, we have gotten the labs to work with them as far as like specimens, shuttling specimens back and forth. And I think that's a really important potential use for public health labs, is to get some of these other commercial labs validated to do that kind of testing.
Other questions for Sue?
Hi, great job. And just wondering, in all our discussions of resistant GC, and here I've missed some of the presentations around the meeting, but has there been any talk of developing messaging targeting MSM about the importance of resistant GC? And have you worked with any venue owners or anybody else who might be helpful in slowing down the spread of it?
You know, it's interesting that you mention that, because one of the things that we have been agonizing over a little bit has been the message that gets out to the press. When the New England Journal article came out, you know, the press office was like, wow, superbug GC. And I don't mean to diminish that, you know, but I also have lived through, you know, when we hear about MRSA, and then there's the New York Post has those articles that say the bug that ate my face, or, you know, whatever. we are trying. It's a pretty nuanced message that there is decreased susceptibility. We don't know if it's resistance, and I think that's why some of this basic laboratory and clinical science need to be married to come up with those data. So we've thought about the press messages for the general press. I think that the next step has to be working with the community. I don't, you know, for us, the key message here is not about the antibiotic susceptibility. That's for the providers that they really need to know. The message that the MSM community needs to hear, get your butt to the doctors, get screened. You know, the idea of doing sampling from the three key sites, I think that's the message that that really needs to go out to the community, that if you have not been sampled from those three sites and yet you've had exposure in those three sites, then you didn't get a full physical. I guess that's the equivalent of making sure that women know that a pelvic exam doesn't mean that you got either a pap screen or a chlamydia screen. It just means you had a pelvic.
I think Dan's point is interesting. I was trying to think what the messages would be. I'm not sure what we would necessarily tell MSM, but Susan sort of leaned over, and as a little plug, tomorrow she'll be talking about some of the programmatic activities we've been doing in San Francisco. But one message could actually be that if we think you may have resistant gonorrhea, please cooperate with the DIS when they call you, because that's something that we found has really been a challenge, is that if something does come up, our ability to prevent it is going to be really DIS focused, and we're not having huge success with DIS cooperation from our MSM patients.
Well, you know, when we have had to send DIS to, you know, talk to these cases that had the that have had the increased MICs, that's been part of the message, that, you know, it looks like you got treated and that, you know, you got an effective treatment, but we're really very worried. And that's why it's really critical, especially critical, that your partners get the right treatment, because there really aren't a lot of choices, and we need to make sure that they got the right one. So that is on a very individual patient level. But, you know, we still have not come out with the right press message. I have to admit, I know that I think that there's one other jurisdiction that told me that they had written that there was something written for the press, and I still need to review that. But I think we need to be really careful with that message. I mean, we don't want people freaking out, but we do want to make sure that rectal testing is happening by whatever means, and that clinical failures come to our attention so that they can be worked up and then cultured as appropriate. Thank you. Thanks. And thank you to those who invited me.
Thank you.